Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Spesh.
Hello.
What's up, Derek?
Same old, same old. It's a slow time of year, waiting for the snow to stay, and so there's not a lot you can do.
Which is a good thing.
Hmm.
Three words you don't want to hear from your mechanic. Catastrophic engine failure.
Yes, yes, there is that.
It was an expensive driving weekend.
Hmm.
Bright side of it all, at the end of the day, we did make it home before the truck had
issues. The truck actually made it home.
The truck made it home, and then very noisily and slowly, I was able to take it to the mechanic.
So it can't be that catastrophic. It still drives.
In limp mode.
Yeah.
So I can make it up to about 60 kilometers an hour after.
There's
it goes 0 to 60 in like 30 seconds. Yeah, limp mode is supposed to be able to get you to the dealer or whatever.
So something's grinding and crunching inside?
Rattling.
Hmm.
And whatnot. And they said there was some oil pressure issue and there's all these
things. I think you need a second opinion.
I'm going that route. But by what they're saying there, it sounds like it's time for a new truck.
I spent $2,300 today. Not like you're going to spend on a truck.
What'd you buy? Did you buy a truck?
I got some trees taken down.
Oh, you got trees taken
down. Yeah. Trees that my neighbor has been asking, hey, are you going to take that tree down? She's asked me quite a few times now. Because
no is a correct answer.
Well, no. It did have to come down. I just procrastinate. But
why?
Well, it's there is a windstorm in the January of 2023, and it was leaning over at a 40-some degrees over, 35 degrees over. So it was leaning good. The ground was popping up behind it. And
over her property.
Over her fence, yeah.
Tell her to get insurance. It's my tree. Get insurance, lady. Yeah,
exactly. What are you worried about?
Yeah. Tree killer?
I'm losing a tree.
Yeah.
You're just going to lose a fence.
The squirrels are losing their homes. The birds are losing their places to perch upon.
I think it might reach her patio. So take out her fence, patio, and shed. But I'm losing a tree.
Right? And a big hole in the ground.
Yeah. Anyways, I now have
a big hole?
I have firewood.
Ah.
So, yeah.
It'll have to take a little bit to dry. It wasn't a dead tree.
No, it's a very live tree, so it'll take about a year or so. I have to split them and then pile them, and they'll be burnable next in about a year, 18 months or something.
So what you're saying is it's perfect campfire wood in about a year.
In about a year. It'll be good campfire wood. Yep.
Okay, so if anybody's got $20, you can just text me the money, and I will tell you Derek's address.
Going in my fireplace. I have a wood-burning fireplace, so I'm happy.
There's people out back my house stealing my wood.
Hey!
Sean sent us. It was okay. We sent him $20.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's pine, so it's not the best.
Does it burn?
It will burn. It just burns faster.
Oh, exotic pine. Fast burning.
Yeah.
$30.
Well, you know, if there's a blackout and I need to heat my house in the middle of winter.
$40.
But yeah, so now I have some wood.
Yeah, sometimes it's got to be done. I mean, that was happening with our apple tree.
Yeah.
It started leaning over. It was destroying the shed. The shed moved, and then it really started. But it was going to hit the corner where four fences met.
Oh.
And it would just have hit the window at the side of our one neighbor's house. So, yeah, unfortunately, that apple tree had to come down because, you know, that would have been a bit expensive at the end of the day.
I tried watching them on my backyard camera, but I missed all the trees falling.
Oh.
Oh, well.
Eh, what are you going to do? So, it's been cold here. We're doing, hopefully doing the smoker on the weekend.
One last. Hey, I saw, I sent you the thing. peanut butter cups wrapped in bacon. Smoked for about 2 hours, 2.5 hours. So it's mostly peanut butter, so it won't melt out. There's a little bit of chocolate, but It just sounds so delicious. You know,
those are two really tasty items separately. There are some things that just do not go together. Like the hot dog.
Hot dog pickle and
jelly pie. Jergello, I guess it was pie. Yeah. Yeah. All good separately. But I don't know if you want them together.
I like
it.
I like pickle sandwiches. Pickle mustard in bread or in a wrap.
Yeah, we call those hot dogs.
No, but...
Because we usually put a wiener in with those.
Yeah. Well, that would be good, too. That'd be good, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm getting hungry now.
Me, too. Yeah.
Let's just press pause and go get something to eat. No show. This is our show this week, all 5 minutes. I was thinking about our buddy John. John Van Berger heading down to the States.
Oh, yes.
So you've spent last winter out in the drier states.
Arizona, California.
Yeah, and all that. And that's all... pretty close to Nevada. Now, when you think of Nevada, of course, you're thinking...
Is it Nevada or Nevada?
Las Vegas. Las Vegas.
Nevada.
That's what you're thinking about.
So
Nevada.
Where's he going this year?
I'd probably same place he went last year, yeah.
You haven't talked to him. I thought you talked to him.
No, I haven't talked to him in a little bit. I just know from our previous conversation that's what he does right now.
Yeah, we followed him along. He chatted with us a few times.
Yep. He looks like Forrest Gump now.
Yes, he does.
Yep.
But with that in mind, you were looking up trips.
Yes.
And travels.
Trips and travels.
Nevada.
Because everybody thinks Nevada is Las Vegas, all gambling.
Yep.
That's all anybody thinks of, right?
Hmm.
More than 85% of Nevada is public lands and includes rivers and lakes perfect for beginner kayakers and seasoned boaters. What awaits kayakers goes beyond the idyllic floats. If you find yourself camping after a day on the water, you'll be greeted with the darkest skies in the lower 48. Or if you want to soak in natural hot springs to break up the day, Nevada has the most hot springs in the U.S. You learn as you start to Google stuff. With its 27 state parks and a national park and plenty of lakes and streams, kayak adventures are easy to find in Nevada. Many of the locations... that we're going to talk about on this little list here are lakes and perfect for beginner paddlers or seasoned boaters looking for a mellow float. Doesn't all have to be fast moving water. Just a nice, easy, mellow float.
Scenic. Time to smell the flowers.
Yes. As with any waterway, seasonal flows vary and your skill level for navigating rapids and rivers will need to be accounted for. Always check local flow levels with a relevant managing park, state, or federal agency. So, some places that you want to check out if you're Nevada bound with your boats.
Mm-hmm.
Black Canyon Water Trail. First beginner-friendly kayaking spot isn't flat water, but is still ideal for less seasoned paddlers looking for slow-moving water with plenty of history, caves, and even hot springs. Located in the Lake Mead National Recreation Area and flowing between the famous Hoover Dam and El Dorado Canyon, this section of the lower Colorado River offers paddlers a choose-your-own-adventure-style float, which is perfect. Most popular starting point for Black Canyon Water Trail is below Hoover Dam, second tallest dam in the U.S., built in 1936. More than 7 million people visit that dam every year. But significantly fewer paddle downriver from the dam on the Black Canyon Water Trail. Before heading out to the paddle, be sure to check the flow release schedule. Because that could be not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Paddlers can enjoy a peaceful river float downriver, stopping at Willow Beach, Arizona, or pushing through on the full 30-mile trip to El Dorado Canyon. Along the way, you can enjoy sandy beaches, caves and coves, secluded hot springs, and hiking trails. For the history buffs, stops around Hoover Dam include gauging stations, river-spanning catwalks, and building foundations. So that's what's so good about stuff like this is that you can get out of the boat for
yeah.
a while
and
do a little hike or a little exploration or see a little bit of historical stuff, then jump back in the boat and continue on.
Yeah, like if you were going to do like Colorado River where the walls are high and steep, there's whipping by. Occasionally you come to a sandbar where you can camp and set up camp, but otherwise it's like, let's go!
Oh, like right? The Grand Canyon.
Yeah, Grand Canyon, yeah.
Most paddlers end their trip at Willow Beach, Arizona, where a full-service marina and parking lot for your return vehicle or shuttles await. Strong paddlers can launch at Willow Beach and paddle upriver to the dam and then back down for a round-trip adventure, or continue on down the less trafficked half of the Black Canyon Water Trail through El Dorado Canyon, which is rich in geological history.
Hmm.
That sounds pretty cool.
It does. That sounds just right up right at this and is I my think speed.
It would all depend on, like they say, strong paddler. So I got to think you're not solo paddling up to Hoover and back.
Probably not. But with a couple paddlers,
mm-hmm.
picking your lines, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a plan. Ruby Lake National Wildlife Refuge. Situated on the eastern edge of the Ruby Mountains, Ruby Lake National Wildlife Refuge is an oasis in the Great Basin. The area is made of a network of spring-fed marshes, wet meadows, and a 12-foot-deep lake that brings in an abundance of wildlife, including 220 species of birds. So if you're a birder...
There you go.
The refuge is 40,048 acres in total and is a dream for birders and wildlife enthusiasts.
If you wanted to see how many of those 220 species of birds are, you could use that Merlin app and see how many of them are loons.
All of them are loons. You get a loon. You get a loon. Everybody gets a loon. Anglers flock to the area for trout and largemouth bass, while those looking for a calming place to watch wildlife will be overjoyed at the bounty. From sandhill cranes to trumpeter swans and sage grouse, the area is a wildlife haven. Before you embark on the paddling adventure, be sure to read up on how to safely navigate the labyrinth of marsh. Anglers need to be sure to get a Nevada State fishing license before casting. Walker Lake Recreation Area. Walker Lake is a remnant of the ancient Lake Lahontan and the ancestral home of the Walker River Paiute tribe. Beginning in the late 19th century, the lake's water source, the Walker River, began to be diverted for irrigation, and this has caused a dramatic decline in the water levels of the lake. Paddlers can still enjoy the lake rising out of the desert landscape, and if they're lucky, even spot the bighorn sheep in the area. Those are cool to see. Best of all, the surrounding mountains protect the lake from erratic weather, means no matter what time of year, paddlers can enjoy calm weather and sunshine. I bet we could go there and prove that wrong. As all the headwinds hit us nonstop.
I was just Googling Walker Lake Recreation Area.
Yeah.
Apparently, there's one in Pennsylvania. So now I have to fix it and find the one that's in Nevada.
Yeah, find the one in Nevada.
Hawthorne, Nevada.
The next one is Rye Patch State Recreation Area. Nearly 23,000 years ago, the Humboldt River fed the ancient lake and supported animals like camelops, mammoths, and bison.
What's the first one? What?
Camelops.
Say again?
Camelops? Camel? Ops.
I gotta Google that.
Or camelopes. I just thought it was ops. Anyway, fast forward to the present day, and boaters can enjoy remnants of the Great Lake in the Rye Patch State Recreation Area, 72 miles of shoreline around the reservoir, and 11,000 acres of state recreation area. It offers plentiful outdoor adventure and paddle opportunities, from trophy class fishing and sunny days for kayaking along the reservoir. Paddlers can enjoy the outdoors without fighting the crowds, which is awesome. Because there's nothing like being in a popular place and too many boats.
It's a breed of camel.
See?
It was in North America. It was from the late Pliocene to the end of the Pleistocene epoch. Huh. 7 foot tall at the shoulder.
That's just a foot taller than me.
It's a tall animal. Yeah. I guess camels are tall on their own anyways.
Right? So are giraffes and elephants.
They went extinct 10,000 to 12,000 years ago. All gone.
With the mammoths.
Well, apparently the mammoths were around as early as 3,500.
Yeah, weren't they around like like the Nile was, or the Egyptians and stuff were building their pyramids when the mammoths were still around.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
I wouldn't go by the movie, though.
What movie?
Where they used mammoths to haul the stones up the pyramids.
Oh, I've never seen that movie.
I think it was called 10,000 BC, I think the name of the movie was.
Oh, yeah, no, I never saw that. Anyway, I'm thinking they're probably farther north at that point, not actually hanging around the desert.
I didn't know there was camels in North America.
I didn't know there was a desert mammoth.
True.
Walker River State Recreation Area. For 125 years, this stretch of the Walker River was under private ownership until the Walker Basin Conservancy acquired the area's historic ranches. 2018, they donated a large tract of land to the state, transforming the area into what is now a popular destination for recreation. 12,000-acre riparian paradise.
Riparian paradise.
Yep. Including 29 miles of the East Walker River, has camping, hiking, paddling, and wildlife viewing. While not all of the ranch units are open to the public, paddlers will find plenty of riverway to float on this historic section of the Silver State. Hmm. Depending on the seasonal water flows, the river will vary in difficulty. Beginner-level kayaking is found within the state recreation area. However, the Walker River extends beyond the state recreation area, and this section is not considered beginner. So when you see that sign, you are now leaving? Turn around. Get to the shore, turn around. Always check river flows with local management prior to heading out on the river.
That's a huge area.
Yeah?
Holy cow.
Second to last, Pyramid Lake. Pyramid Lake is another sacred remnant of the prehistoric Lake Lahontan and home to the Pyramid Lake tribe. The lake is special for many reasons, including species of plants and animals that can only be found in the lake, and the Kiwi suckerfish. The lake is also home to the Anaho Island Wildlife Refuge, National Wildlife Refuge, which is protected habitat for thousands of migratory birds and the largest breeding ground for the American white pelican. Oh, I had to take my whole family there just so they can see that there's pelicans.
Oh, didn't you? That was out in Alberta, didn't you?
That was in Alberta. There ain't no pelicans in Alberta.
There's pelicans.
Well, look at that there. Even the dog got in the action there to go point out the pelican till it realized how big the pelican was and made a hasty retreat.
Whoa!
Yeah, my dog looks like a hunting dog, but is not a hunting dog. The refuge is not open to the public, but can be viewed from Pyramid Lake. Lake is about 45 minutes northwest of Reno.
Yes,
offers
very close.
Legendary trophy fishing, bird watching, camping, and more. Paddlers are in for a wild adventure on the lake, which is 15 miles long, 11 miles wide, and up to 350 feet deep. Huh. Area is prone to high winds. Aha! Means we're going.
Well, there's open areas, right?
So. And can quickly turn a casual paddle into an extreme sport if you're not careful. Be mindful of weather advisories. Try to aim for morning floats to avoid afternoon storms. Note that any recreation in the area requires a permit from the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe.
Hmm.
Hmm.
Wow, there's so many parks in this area. But I guess it's all very isolated, too. It's like, might as well make it a park. Nobody's going to live there.
Right? And the last one, East Fork of the Carson River. This section of the Carson River ranges from wilderness class 2 to short class 3 and offers a bit of everything for the adventurous kayaker, from whitewater to gentle rapids, dramatic rock formations, and hot springs. 20-mile stretch of the East Fork on the Carson River is great for every kind of outdoor enthusiast. So there's some pretty cool paddle opportunities there.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of branches of the Carson River. Mm-hmm. Like, it spreads out like a spider web.
Yeah. Oh. So that's, yeah, when you start looking at, like I say, when you start looking at the hot spots and the desert areas, you're not thinking, oh, not nothing there. But then when you actually start,
there's a lot of waterways.
There is a lot of waterways there. And I mean, when you're talking things like the Hoover Dam and whatnot, you got to watch them to see when they're going to release the flow and stuff like that, right? Hmm. Because that could be dangerous if it's too much.
Well, that's fascinating. Like, to look at the map, I love maps.
Right?
And but to look at the map, there's so many different routes and waterways that are shown. It's pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm. So if you plan on going kayak kayak trip in Nevada, take Derek, please. No matter where you drop your boat in Nevada, you're sure to have an adventure with millions of acres of public lands and truly wild and historic waterways. Nevada is a destination for history buffs and wildlife enthusiasts alike. But they're mostly talking about birds.
Yeah.
Right? And the bighorn sheep. If you decide to go boating in a Nevada state park or on tribal lands, be sure to check out permitting with local management offices. Always, whenever you're exploring the outdoors, practice leave no trace principles and be sure you're prepared for the level of paddling you're getting yourself into. And check out the, we talked about it there a couple weeks ago, about the, whatever you bring in, you got to bring out.
Oh, yes.
So get the disposable toilet things.
You
bought one, didn't you?
No. Actually, I do have one for camping up north. But anyways, neither here nor there. That's mostly for winter camping with two women in the family, right? So, anyways, it made me forget what I was going to say. I was looking at, I read a story about a guy. He did the Grand Canyon, Colorado River, yada, yada, yada. And nobody likes to be the, oh, there's a name for it. Forgot it already. But the guy who always packs up the toilets.
Yeah, the treasure box.
Yeah, the treasure box. Because you have to pack it all out.
Yep.
Anyways, so he said, hey, I'll do it for the whole trip. So he did do it. And he took a picture of each setup. And now it's in a calendar. I tried to buy it, and it's sold out.
Well, that's like there's a calendar out there of dogs in scenic places taking poops.
I bought that calendar for my family last year for Christmas. I was hoping for this one for Christmas for everybody, too. But it sold out almost immediately, and I'm currently on a waiting list.
Yes, but it's a juvenile mind.
It's so scenic, though. His toilets are so scenic. He's really set the pictures up nicely, and he freaked out a lot of people because so many people use these campsites, you can't leave anything on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So you pack up the poo, and you throw the pee in the river, because it's a solution to pollution is dilution. And everybody goes, whoa, what are you doing? He's like, no, this is what the park says. They demand that you pick up and pack out the poop and you throw the pee in the river. It's the rule. It's written on paper. You have to do this. They do not want you putting the, they don't want people going and peeing against a rock.
Right.
Do not do that. Do not pee on the ground, because if there's a 1,000 people over summer, it's going to reek, and all the bacteria growing in the sand.
And erosion,
that too. Anyway, so he created this calendar. It's a nice looking calendar. The poop setups are really nice. It's like, it's scenic. It's got mountains in the background.
Well, I've been in Tamagami and Algonquin, and there's a couple sites that when you sit on the Thunderbox, it's got a nice view.
Oh, it's very nice.
I know one particular site that when you sit on the Thunderbox, it's up a hill, and you get a nice look at the lake.
Yeah.
But when you're paddling by, you can't see that Thunderbox.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So you can
Look at
be
people paddle
there
by.
Having your morning constitutional, watching your buddies paddle on by, and they don't even know you're there.
There's a campsite on Preacher Point in Tamagami, right as you enter Lady Evelyn, and so you into the campsite, and really nice campsite, hard to get in the summer. It's very popular, It's called Preacher Point. Anyways, there's two thunder boxes on the hill overlooking the campsite and the lake, and they're side by side. It's like, who does that?
Right.
There were two brand spanking, not like there's an old one and a new one. There's two brand new thunder boxes within 3 feet of each other.
So, hey, Jim, you need to poop? Yeah, Phil, let's go.
Let's hold hands. We found the same thing at Moon River. It's like, who's doing this? Who sets up like thunder boxes like 3 feet apart?
Okay, so you got your map there, Bill? Check something out here.
But the in the Des Moines River, when we did the Burt Reynolds trip, we found a whole series of thunder boxes doing that run, and they're all painted with really nice artwork. And I keep forgetting because I have pictures of them all. It's like, that's a calendar. That right? is a whole calendar of these beautifully painted thunder boxes with this really nice artwork. It's like, wow, I got to make a calendar of this. But I keep forgetting. I just thought of it now. I haven't thought about that in a couple of years.
See? You have your own calendar idea.
Exactly. I want to do it.
You could do it, sell it, and have the money proceeds to that trail there.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah. I want to do that trail. I definitely want to do that trail. Like, what you could do is the plan would be to take a pack boat, hike up, and paddle back.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That'd be the plan. Look forward to that.
I'll write someday. That down on my list.
Yes.
List of places to go.
Yeah.
So, you sent me a couple of articles.
I did. Last week. Yes.
You sent me a couple.
I did not know the connection. I had no idea.
Really? So, Paddling Mag published an article, issue 74, titled 100-Year-Old Barren Lands Canoe Expedition Mystery Solved. And this is pretty cool. And this is one of the bonuses of technology today with internet searches, Google Maps, and all that sort of stuff. Husband and wife paddling team set out on a 1,000-mile, 64-day, unsupported canoe trip through Canada's northern barren lands to solve a century-old mystery. They knew success would be like finding a needle in a haystack. So 100 years prior, John Hermit of the North Hornby, British financier John Critchell Bullock, set out on a bold expedition. Their goal was to paddle into the Barren Lands, capture the first motion picture footage of muskoxen,
yes.
believed to be extinct back then.
And they're still not.
Yeah, believe it or not, I've seen pictures.
Thompson River, if we ever do Banks Island, we're going to see them on Thompson River.
Right. By the expedition's second summer in 1925, which was 100 years ago.
Yes.
Their trip had turned into a fight for survival. The men were exhausted, starving, and still 500 kilometers from the nearest outpost. Desperation, they decided to lighten their load. On a small island in the middle of the Hanbury River, we dumped 10,000 feet of unused motion picture film and a 1,000-pound movie camera, as in...
Pounds, dollars.
Pounds, dollars.
Money. Sterling the money pounds.
Bullock wrote that, and he says, we were too starved to carry it. He snapped a photo of the cache, a mound of rocks against a barren landscape. Then his journal disappeared for 85 years. 2015, a school clerk in England found Bullock's writings tucked in a drawer. 2 years later, they were published in the book Letters from the Barren Lands. For us, it was a fantastic Indiana Jones puzzle to solve after 100 years, says Polish paddler Michael Lukaszewicz and his wife Karolina Gawanitz. They were captivated by the idea of finding the cache. We thought, how hard could it be?
How hard was it to get the stuff there in the first place?
Yeah.
But then they had a lot heavier gear, a lot heavier. Like, we are all, everything is ultra-light.
They were just trying to find stuff, not carry stuff in.
Yeah. Right?
couple pored over Bullock's journals, satellite imagery, and maps. They cross-referenced the research with other canoeists who had paddled the same route. One location emerged as the cache's most likely hiding spot. In 2023, Michael and Carolina launched their expedition to unearth the cache. 2-month-long self-supported canoe trip from Yellowknife to Baker Lake.
Even still, 2 months, that's a long trip. Wow.
Right? Following Hornby and Bullock's path through the tundra. I gotta think they probably just could have landed there. But
that defeats the purpose.
It defeats the purpose, yeah. Right? Yeah. It's the adventure and the in it all. It was amazing but punishing as well, Michael said. When we read Bullock's letters, we felt his pain and dilemmas, and when we traveled through the barren lands, we experienced them firsthand. At which point he said we could have just landed there.
And so what's funny is, so they're going by the book, the diary. So they dictated or they wrote their story as they go through the trip. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, oh, they were talking about this. Must be here. This must be here. This must be here. We did the same thing with what was it? Path of the Paddle? What was the...
The Incomplete Anglers.
Incomplete Anglers, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
When we followed the route the Incomplete Anglers did through Algonquin Park.
And I remember us reading the book during the trip. It's like, hey, let's do this part. Let's do this part. So we kind of followed along. And
that's cool.
It was. It was neat to follow in somebody's footsteps.
Mm-hmm. Day 42, the couple reached Grove Rapids on the Hanbury River and suspected cache site. Most paddlers portage past this area, which could explain why the cache had remained undiscovered. They climbed to the highest point for a panoramic view and scanned the landscape. What would not have changed in 100 years, in the blurred background of the photo, they notice a cube-shaped erratic boulder. Behind it, a small lake matched Bullock's photograph. That's got to be like a...
Yeah, it's like, oh, there's this is not going to change.
Yeah. When I looked through my binoculars, I saw this massive cube-shaped erratic boulder. I thought, come on, this is probably it. 30 minutes later, there it was. A mound of boulders human hands hadn't touched since Bullock and Hornby laid it down. The entire scene matched Bullock's photograph 99%. We felt chills running down our spines. Now, question for you, Derek.
Mm-hmm.
Do you look or you... just leave it be and not tell anybody you found it. Your own personal Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
I got a secret I found. I know where it is.
I wouldn't tell people where I found it because that's the challenge, right? You don't want to... It's like giving away a good fishing hole or whatever. It's like, oh, no, I found it. I found
or
it.
Or do you take pictures of it close enough that you can't see just to prove you found 100%. It, but not look?
Yeah. Because that'd be the challenge. That'd be the fun part of it is the voyage of discovery, as they say. Mm-hmm. So I'd be really gassed if I was able to find it and locate it and give evidence and whatever, but not make it too easy for the next person.
But would you uncover it? Would you look inside to see if everything was still there?
I would. And simply because it's not a tomb, it's not a burial ground, it's not something that's holistic or, you know, consecrated, yada, yada, yada. So I just yada, that.
You anyways. Yada, yada, it.
Anyways, yeah, it's a cairn. We know that it was for them to stow gear because they just couldn't carry it anymore. They were starving, they were weak, and they had, so it's not like you're defiling anything. It's a cairn of covering their camera gear and film. Mm-hmm. So I would, yes.
Beneath the boulders, they found rusted metal, a piece of wood, and the lid of a film canister. Proof that this was the cache Hornby and Bullock had built a century earlier. But the camera was gone.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I wouldn't look.
Why?
Disappointment.
Oh.
Avoid the disappointment.
But you found it.
Yeah, but after 100 years, what's the chances it's still there?
Well, apparently not very good.
Apparently not very good.
But that's because somebody had come and gotten it.
Right? Hornby had returned to the region with two companions on a famously ill-fated, all three died of starvation, on the Thelon River in 1927.
So 2 years later, they went back and collected the equipment and then died.
They believe Hornby retrieved the camera during that trip, likely hoping to sell it. Through disappointment, the camera was missing. Michael and Carolina say the real reward was the connection they felt across time, terrain, and human experience. By reaching the cache site, we felt the strong connection to Bullock and Hornby through the land, says Michael.
So I would dig it up. I would take a look. I wouldn't take anything because that's not my right to take something, but I would want to see it.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't disturb it a lot, but I would leave everything behind for the...
But, I mean, I got to think in 100 years, somebody's probably come across it. And probably taken stuff.
So few people knew about it. So it was a 2015. So only the original people would know exactly where it was.
And yeah, but if people are wandering and accidentally come across
it. I don't think people would accidentally come across that.
I don't know. Maybe. Well, they said that people usually portage past.
Yeah.
But what if people didn't? Hey, look at this.
Yeah, not everybody. So I've just been trained, but all my trips through Algonquin and places like that, it's like, don't take anything. If you find anything historic, do not take it. Leave it. It's part of history. It's part of the environment now. And if you take it, nobody else will see it. Nobody else will gain that energy of finding something. But you leave it behind. Leave it for somebody else to find and enjoy the fact that you found it.
Yes, but we all know people aren't like us.
No, they're not all.
Anyway, so you sent me this article, and it's pretty cool that they found it and all that sort of stuff. Yes, definitely a bummer that they never found the camera.
Sure, but they found bits and pieces.
But they found bits and pieces, so they
knew they had the right spot.
Yeah. The reason this article sparked my curiosity was mentioning of John Hornby, and in particular the end when they mentioned Hornby's ill-fated journey to the Thelon River.
In 1927.
Hap Wilson wrote a book entitled Dance of the Dead Men.
So it was about that journey, the second journey.
Hear those pages?
Good thing you explained it.
Right?
Everybody's going, what's that noise?
What is that noise? Hornby recruited his 19-year-old cousin Edgar Christian and 29-year-old Harold Adler to accompany him on a trek to the Thelon River in Northwest Territories. Neither of the two had any type of survival training or outdoor experience.
Great plan.
Right? If you read the book, you'll find out that Hornby had not planned to take his nephew the entire way. There was something else
that was
supposed to
happen. He was going to abandon him sooner?
Yeah, he's going to abandon him somewhere. I don't know, sacrifice him to the bear gods. due to a combination of bad timing, bad luck, not enough experience, things don't go as planned. I really enjoyed this book because Hap takes all the historical bits.
Yeah.
Basically, he took the history of what happened on the trip because they know what happened based on Hornby's diaries.
Oh, diaries.
Oh, yeah. Okay. The last one to die wrapped all the diaries and journals and put it in the stove.
Oh.
The steel stove.
Yeah, to save
To save it from predators, mice, all that sort of stuff. So they had all the diaries and everything that happened.
That's good.
So he took all of that and wrote out, here's what all happened. But then he added from his own experience on how things go and his own...
What he estimates would have happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Plus more research and details. He basically turned it into a story in their words.
Yeah.
On here's what... like a first-person sort of story.
Yeah.
It is really well done. This is one of the first books of Hap's I read that I'm just... I'm like, yeah, and this is what got me reading all the rest of Hap's stuff, right? If you go to hapwilson.com, you can get Dance of the Dead Men, and it's a good read. If you know anybody that likes historical-type outdoor adventure books, Christmas is coming. And if you go there and leave a message for Hap saying, Sean from Paddling Adventures Radio told me I need to get this book from you, you won't get a discount, but I'll look good.
Yes, exactly. Sean sent me.
He said, I got to buy this book? Yes, you do.
That'll bring you a Scooby snack.
Right? So, yeah, HapWilson.com, get your Dance of the Dead Men. But how cool is that to go on some big adventure like this and find something over 100 years old?
It would be truly amazing. Right?
And like I say, I mean, you'd sit there and look at that mound for a while thinking, just take it all in before diving in.
Mm-hmm.
But could you imagine if there was... I guess depending on if they'd left anything there, like...
True.
Now, they said that they had left a whole bunch of unused film. But if there was any film in the camera...
That might have,
Would it still have been able to get...
I think it would be too old
today,
because they said there was just bits and pieces from the film canister, so it was well rusted. It was.
I wonder how bad the condition the camera would have been in.
Would
it have protected that film inside enough?
I don't know.
Because if it was still there, they would have had to wrap that really well.
Yeah,
and put it like in bubble wrap.
If it was oil cloth, some kind of canvas or...
But knowing that they would have to then take it the rest of the trip, you'd want to bring something with you to wrap that in. Like, you would wrap your sleeping bag around that.
Yeah.
Just to make sure it didn't get damaged.
Mm-hmm. Because that would be of historical significance if there was still film in the camera.
That would be really cool.
Very interesting. So the two that did this trip and they found the cairn.
Yeah.
Like, it took them 2 months. Is there an... They picked a very long route. I wonder if there's
figure if you're going up that way, you might as well enjoy the trip at the same time.
2 months?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Great time up there.
How much... Like, there's no place to do food drops. You'd have to carry too much food.
Yeah.
2 months worth of food.
Yeah.
That's a lot of food.
And if you're fishing.
Yeah. Well, you definitely have to supplement.
You wouldn't want to eat fish again forever. Well, I mean, in these days and times too, with all the dehydrated stuff and and whatnot. Oh, yeah. I mean, you're going to be packing heavy for two people, but.
Yeah. Well, look at Wes Hansen. When they did the Northwest Passage, they had all these individual daily bricks of food and freeze dried this and oatmeal that. And so it was very condensed caloric energy packs, very well planned out and designed. So it was very lightweight, but they still had to, resupply. A couple of times. Cambridge Bay and I can't remember the other one.
But my big thing of doing something like that would be how much of the powder for your water.
What?
Like I take the powder for the electrolytes.
Electrolytes.
To your water.
Powdered water.
No, powder for your
for
water.
For your water.
Yeah. How much powdered water do you have to take?
Yeah, you just have to rehydrate it, put water in
it. Just add water to your water and get water. the electrolyte water and stuff like that.
Yes, yeah.
Right?
Because you are working hard, you want to replenish. Mm-hmm. Because even if you're not excessively drinking, if you're still, you have to drink, if it's a difficult route or if it's hot, you're still drinking a lot of water, you are reducing the amount of, you're diluting the electrolytes in your body, plus you're kind of dumping some out.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have to add something.
Yeah. Add that one to the list.
I want to do that route.
Just write that on the list.
So, Banks Island, Thalon River.
So, what we need to do is start out in Lake Erie from the most southern point of Canada and paddle all the way up to the most northern point in Canada and then all the way across via all these rivers.
Just like the Voyageurs.
All the way up to Tuktoyaktuk.
Yep.
And then straight down to the west coast, and then straight across Canada back to the southern point of Canada.
Yeah.
Do a big circle.
That might be a little much.
No, that'll only take about 8-9 years.
8-9 years.
After we retire, because, like, what else are you going to do?
Exactly.
Right? Think of the money you'll save.
I know, right?
On rent.
Yeah.
Right? And gas money.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome.
let's do it.
I don't know. Grandpa left after he retired. We saw him at his retirement party and haven't seen him in 8 years.
Where's Daddy? He's on a long trip.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, Mom kicked him out.
I'd love to do some kind of epic trip like that.
Right?
That'd be amazing.
One day, my son. One day. let's travel over to Africa. South Africa, to be precise.
Cape Town.
Cape Town, to be preciser. Members of the Khayelitsha Canoeing Club.
Did you look up that pronunciation?
I did, and I may still be wrong.
The Khayelitsha?
May still be wrong.
Khayelitsha Canoe Club.
Pleading with city of Cape Town to clear the waterways of the Khayelitsha Wetlands Park, also known as the Blowy Wetlands, which are filled with pollution and invasive hyacinth. The Blowy Wetlands are used by the club to paddle, but it is overrun with hyacinth, blocking waterways.
You can buy hyacinth for your backyard ponds and stuff.
Yes.
And it's one of those things, it's like, you kind of wonder, it's like, why am I able to buy this so easily? Like, if I were
because
to drop
they can't
this
get
in
rid
a,
of it.
It. But if you bought it and dumped it in a local wetland, it's just going to take over.
Yep. And everybody will hate you.
Yep.
Because we will have video and I will put it everywhere. Akona Sopankisa, co-founder of the club, said that since September 2024, residents have had to divert sewage water from their homes into the canals, causing the hyacinth to grow.
Did they say why they had to?
He said this was because a sewage pipe caused their drains to malfunction.
Well,
city of Cape Town fixed the problem about 4 weeks ago, but the sewage remains in the wetland.
Well, it was dumped there. It's going to be there.
Volunteers now spend about 2 hours each week removing the invasive hyacinth. Says we can't work for too long in the dirty water because the smell is overwhelming.
Yeah.
We don't know what diseases we will catch. So they have asked the city for machinery to better remove the hyacinth so they can use the waterway again. He says they have not been able to teach youngsters canoeing in the wetland or take tourists there for months. To generate income, we are now focusing on walking tours, which involves taking tourists to community gardens where we use biochar as fertilizer.
Let's go to the canoe club and go for a hiking tour.
Right? I went to a hockey game and WWE broke out.
Yeah.
Sopankisa and his brother Siyanda founded the Khayelitsha Canoe Club in 2023. They now work with over 20 volunteers to remove the hyacinth and rubbish from the wetland. And so they showed a picture of this. If you saw that picture and I said, so where's the river? You would think, well, yeah, not here. Is it, I don't know. Is it like 20 miles
it's
the other way?
Filled or, in, eh?
Like, you cannot see water or anything that resembles water anywhere in the picture.
I imagine it's just there's so much like, I don't know, fertilizer, I guess, human fertilizer, that the hyacinth just grows so crazy.
One volunteer said the overflowing sewage may be killing the wetland's fauna, including turtles and crabs. We no longer see mudfish, which locals often fished for.
I don't know. You want to eat anything out of there anyways.
Not now. The Mako Committee member for Water and Sanitation said the city plans to remove alien plants in Blowy starting in January.
Huh.
That's going to be fun. Invasive water hyacinth is a free-floating aquatic plant that is invasive in many parts of the world, originating in the Amazon basin. A common ornamental plant that can form dense, thick mats on water, outcompeting native species for light and nutrients, and disrupting ecosystems and human activities. So we've talked about invasive species before.
Yes.
And, it says, what makes water hyacinth so invasive? And when you start going into this, and you're like, there's ways, like, I mean, it's very invasive.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hard, and it's fast. And there's ways to get rid of it, but every way to get rid of it
is damaging. So nuke it from orbit. It's the only way to be sure.
Pretty much. Yeah. It can double its population in as little as 2 weeks and grow at an extremely fast rate. Primarily spreads through vegetative reproduction, but also reproduces by seeds, which can remain dormant for years.
Oh, no.
So when you're ripping all this stuff out and you're dropping seeds to the bottom,
you're just
yay, we got rid of all. And then 2 years later, boot.
Yeah.
You're right back where you started from.
It would have to be an ongoing project.
It would. It thrives in freshwater habitats like shallow ponds, wetlands, slow-moving rivers, and lakes. And the dense mats of water hyacinth block sunlight and consume nutrients, killing off other aquatic plants and reducing biodiversity. So by having these hyacinths floating on the top of the water, blocking sunlight and all that sort of stuff, you're killing all the other plants and animals that are in there.
But I guess in a way, you're kind of cleaning up all the human fertilizer. Not in the ideal manner, but...
Yeah. It reduces water quality, slows water flow, can lead to oxygen depletion, also creates stagnant water, which can increase the breeding grounds for mosquitoes that carry diseases. It can block irrigation canals and disrupt recreational activities like boating, so it's an economic thing as well.
Yep.
It outcompetes native species for resources, can lead to significant changes in the structure of aquatic ecosystems.
So if they were to dump a bunch of zebra mussels, it could outcompete the hyacinth.
Mm.
But then you got mussels.
Yeah.
Not a great plan, but it's a plan.
Everything that can get rid of them
becomes a problem itself.
Becomes a problem itself. So they talk about some mechanical, chemical, biological, and prevention. Ways of removing and control. Cutting or pulling the plant can break it into fragments, so removal must be done carefully to avoid further spreading. Herbicides can be used, but they may have negative impacts on the surrounding water and ecosystem. Introducing predators like specific weevil beetles is another method, though it can take a long time to be effective. Mm. And then what do you do with all these weevil beetles?
Well, I imagine they might just die off once their food supply dies off.
Primary way to manage its spread is to avoid introducing it to new waterways. Never release ornamental plants from ponds into natural water systems.
That's a good rule to go by.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, like I say, you see this water hyacinth and you would not know there was water under them. You would think it was a green pasture of these plants until you took your first step and it wasn't solid.
They had a sewage failure, so a short-term fix created a long-term problem.
Yep. And the sewage is still there.
Oh, yeah, it's still there. It still lingers, but they fixed it, so there's no new sewage going in, but the old sewage is still there. And it's become a food source for this hyacinth.
Oh. Yeah. Staying on that south other side of the world, Australia. Talking a lot about Australia over the last couple months. They've really been ramping up support for paddling athletes and programs over the last couple of years, probably partly due because of the Brisbane Olympics in 2032. But this isn't a bad thing. So there's a press release that's come out now about another partnership, the Oceania Canoeing Association, the OCA, pleased to acknowledge the support of the Australian government through its Pacific Oz Sports Partnership with the Australian Olympic Committee, created to provide Pacific athletes with access to high-performance training and elite competition. Through this support and in partnership with OCA, an Oceania talent team of Pacific canoe athletes will attend the Oceania Canoe Development Camp and Regatta in Tikitapu, New Zealand. Delegation will be led by OCA development officers and supported by senior coaches and presenters from across the region. So these athletes, so when you're thinking over there, you're thinking Australia, New Zealand, Tasmania.
Yep.
right? Samoa and the Cook Islands.
Oh.
There's all those islands down there.
So many.
That are sort of grouped into that Pacific
yep.
area, right? And when they showed a picture of these athletes, they're all like young teens.
Mm-hmm.
So they're starting that next generation of, and they're bringing them in with this program with these high-level elite coaches and stuff to give them all this training and start them on that path that eventually, hopefully down the road, ends up high-level athletes, paddling athletes, right?
Yep.
Australian Olympic Committee CEO Mark Arbib said, Pacific Aus Sports is about more than funding. It's about creating real opportunities for Pacific athletes. He says Pacific athletes.
Well, that's where
not just that one. It's not Australian.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not New Zealand.
Yeah.
It's the Pacific athletes.
It's the region.
Mm-hmm. Test themselves in world-class environments. Canoeing is a sport that demands resilience, skill, and teamwork, and this development camp and regatta will give our Pacific neighbors the chance to sharpen those qualities on the water. The AOC is proud to stand alongside Oceania Canoeing and helping athletes and coaches prepare for the milestones ahead from next year's Oceania Championships through the Pacific Games, LA 2028, and Brisbane 2032. So they're out there helping out. The OCA Secretary General Danielle Woodward commented, "This is an exciting moment for canoeing in our region, bringing athletes and coaches from across the Pacific to Tiki Tapu isn't just about racing. It's about building a united team of nations who learn, grow, and push each other to new levels. Development camp and regatta will combine high-performance training with cultural exchange, fostering a deeper connection among all participants to the sport, to one another. The lessons learned here, both on and off the water, will stay with these athletes well beyond the week, shaping their journeys to the OCA championships, the Pacific Games, and the Olympic stage. I'm immensely proud of the talent we're bringing together and can't wait to see what they achieve." How cool.
It is very cool.
They're having all these new opportunities for young paddlers and stuff. And like I said, I think a big part of it is because Brisbane 2032.
Yes. And we've talked about the development and the lead-in yep. for Brisbane 2032 as well on other programs specifically for Australia to get new people,
yep.
get young blood into the sports. Because the more people you can push through, without opportunity, you don't know what your potential is. And that's why opportunity is so important.
Yep.
So if you get enough youth in Australia, or in this case, in the region, involved in these things that lead into the sport, then it gives, you don't know, like I said, you don't know who's going to have the skill set to compete at the Olympic level.
Right.
Get as and many
you
people.
You gotta stop somewhere. You start somewhere,
yes,
right?
You have to. Yeah, exactly. So,
and you gotta think, I mean, it's like any of these big extreme sports and high-level energy sports, these athletes have an expiry date.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Right? When you're competing at that level.
Yeah. There's a certain age
you're
range.
Not going to be 65.
Yeah.
And competing.
Yeah.
Not I like, mean, you may, but you're not.
Depends on the sport.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to be keeping
look at
up.
This,
so.
Remember the, I want to say this older gentleman from Turkey who he was in the handgun in the last Olympics.
Oh, the shooting. I wouldn't say he was old guy.
He was older. But, he was like 50s.
But that's not a high energy
no,
sort of
I'm just
thing,
saying.
But,
it's like you don't know.
Yeah.
But when it comes to these high energy output sports like paddling, canoeing, or anything like that, it tends to be a younger person's game.
Yep. Otherwise, if you're doing that at 65, at some point you're going to go, so this is how I die.
Exactly. Yeah.
Every time that starting pistol goes off, I'm waiting for the bullet to put me out of my misery. To stay in Australia, one of Australia's biggest coal export ports resumed operations Monday, being a couple days ago, after climate change protesters disrupted shipping at the port of Newcastle this past Saturday and Sunday. Did the same thing last year.
What are they protesting?
Coal.
Coal exports.
Yep. Climate activist group Rising Tide, which claimed responsibility for the latest protests, says hundreds of activists paddled kayaks into the shipping lane of Newcastle Harbor on Sunday morning, violating an exclusion zone. I can't remember outright, but I think they may have actually stayed out of the exclusion zone last year. But they didn't this year.
Yeah, we read about that last year. It was one of our topics.
Yeah. The port, 170 kilometers or 110 miles north of New South Wales, state capital Sydney, is the largest bulk shipping port on the east coast of Australia, a nation where climate change is a divisive issue. Vessel ops will resume tomorrow as scheduled, the Port of Newcastle spokesperson said on Sunday, after general cargo movements, including alumina bound for Australia's largest aluminum smelter, were aborted due to the protest. Rising Tide said more than 100 protesters were arrested on Sunday. Police did not immediately respond to the request to confirm that number, but said in an earlier statement that 21 people were arrested and charged with alleged marine-related offenses at the protest.
I laugh every time they say alleged. It's like they have to say it. It's legalese. It's like, well, no, we know they were caught red-handed, but it's alleged.
Yeah. Yes.
He allegedly had a knife in his hand when he did the crime.
Right.
Allegedly? I'm sure there was something there.
Greenpeace Australia Pacific said three of its activists climbed onto a coal ship near the port, stopping it from operating, as part of what it said was a peaceful protest. When you start climbing onto the...
Yeah, it's still peaceful, but it's invasive.
Yeah, yeah.
Like hyacinth.
Like the hyacinth, yeah. Greenpeace alongside Rising Tide and thousands of everyday people are taking actions big and small this weekend, Greenpeace Australia Pacific said in a statement. On Saturday, a protest at Newcastle forced an inbound ship to turn back and police made 11 arrests. Similar multi-day climate action occurred last year when 170 protesters were arrested. And they're only at 100 this year.
Mm-hmm.
Slackers. Coal is one of Australia's top commodity exports, along with iron ore. Australia's government has committed to reaching net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050.
So that's them. That's like, okay, they're going to be net zero, but they're still pumping it out to other countries.
Right.
And I think their focus, like one example that always pops in my head when it comes to coal use is primarily Germany, U.S., Germany, China, some of the biggest users. Canada has mostly eradicated coal use, but it's like in Germany, they said, hey, we just don't want nuclear. So they got rid of nuclear and they had to build a whole bunch of coal-fired plants.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
At the end of the day, there's only so many ways that you can get the energy.
Exactly. If you want electricity, you want lights, heat, hydro, lighting, whatever.
Mm-hmm. So,
I'm not a proponent of it. I'm just saying
yeah.
your options are limited.
Yes.
Anyway.
So, if you have nothing better to do with your kayaking time,
go block a ship.
Go block a ship. Well, you know what, though? As long as they know it's happening, they know to look out for these hundreds of
protesters.
So hopefully people don't get hurt. They're making their statement.
Mm-hmm.
They take one weekend of the year to make their statement.
Yeah. And that's all they're doing. They're making a statement.
Yeah. And I would rather see something like that than these people that are blocking streets, sitting in the middle of intersections.
Gluing their hands to tarmac.
People can't get to drop their kids off so they can go to school or their daycare sort of thing. Can't get to the hospital. You blocked me from my job. I can't go make money. And our family's like one half paycheck away from being on the street.
Without having big money involved, it's really hard to get these kind of messages across effectively.
Yeah.
Like if you want to make changes, protests aren't really going to do it because you're just negative backlash. So
it's like throwing the soup on the Mona Lisa.
I know.
What is that going to do?
People are just going to be angry at you.
Yeah.
What you need is you need a lot of money, paid lobbyists to lobby on your behalf to reduce the use of coal and reduce use of fuel and yada, yada, yada. It's, you have to play the game the way the big guys play it, right?
Yippers. You know, like I say, I mean, don't take that as we don't agree with their what they're trying to do.
No, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah,
sometimes
yeah.
The meth, and that's a big thing. There's you can follow this rabbit hole on YouTube and the internet, is they're doing these interviews with these people, and they're going like, well, we're bringing attention to it.
Sure.
Not really. Yeah, okay, but everybody knows, but people know it already. But what you're doing is pissing people off,
yeah.
And they're not taking you seriously.
No, they're not.
And so you're being disregarded.
Mm-hmm.
Your message is being disregarded because you decided you were going to go and destroy a priceless piece of art.
Yeah.
Because our planet is more important.
I get what they're doing. They are trying to draw attention to it in the only way they can. Because without somebody who has really deep pockets with billions of dollars, you're not going to get your message out unless you do this. So they're sending the message,
but it's not being received.
It's counterproductive.
Yeah.
So. Unfortunately. And I don't know a solution. I don't know a better way to...
Nope.
Like what with here in Ontario, they managed to get the politicians on board and we eradicated the use of coal-fired plants.
Mm-hmm.
There's no coal-fired anything in Ontario. So that's
I'm going to change that.
But unfortunately, now they've changed it to natural gas. There's a lot of natural gas being used in Ontario now.
There's some guy over in southern Ontario outside of Toronto. He's got his own little coal thing going on. Thought it was eradicated. Nope.
Yeah.
Anyway. You got anything else?
I don't. I'm worried about all the people that could be mad at us now, thinking that we're sympathetic to coal. It's like, we're not sympathetic to coal.
Well, wait till I get my big old diesel-burning truck.
Got roll coal.
Driving it out there. Oh, that'd be awesome. A nice coal-powered, steam-powered truck.
I want a nuclear-powered truck.
No. Okay. I'm going old school. Steam-powered. Two burners. One burns coal. One burns firewood.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, if that doesn't set him off, I don't know what will.
We're going to get letters. We got letters. We got letters.
I just got a letter.
Lots and lots of letters.
Right? Yeah, hopefully people with smarter brains than ours can figure out the way to get this done.
It progressed technology.
We do our part, and that's, you know.
Yeah.
That carbon counts for something.
Carbon capture will help a lot. Like, mm-hmm. But then you hear about stuff like, oh, well, the Earth is stopping capturing its own carbon. It's like, uh-oh. Are we at a tipping point? We don't know.
I think we need to get the cows to stop releasing methane.
Stop farting, cows.
Right? That'll help. Anyway, if you want to find out more about us... Stay off the internet.
Please don't write us letters.
You can find us at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can download or stream all our episodes on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or you can do it the easy way. You can just go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com. You can stream or download all 511 episodes there.
Oof.
If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with your friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.